tremendously privileged to have with us today our extremely accomplished and erudite panelists. I'd like to begin by calling upon Dr. Beth Popp, who is the Director of Palliative Medicine Division, Associate Program Director of Hematology and Oncology at Maimonides Medical Center. And Dr. Popp will speak to us about palliative care, and I hope also maybe provide a little bit of a framework for the discussion regarding hospice care in general, so we understand what the parameters are of when it's appropriate for people to move into that type of a setting, what a type of environment can be created in terms of putting somebody in either an inpatient or outpatient hospice setting where there can be appropriate consultation with halakhic authorities, and what the considerations are in terms of balancing the pain management with continuing medical care. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. My colleagues and predecessors who spoke already covered most of the material that I usually cover when I speak about these issues. So I revised my comments on the fly, and I'll ask Rabbi Reese to just help me make sure I stay in the time constraints since I've revised them so quickly. The topic that was the title of this morning's session was hospice and halacha. But aside from some passing mention of hospice, nobody's really told the audience what it is. So let me start there, because there are enormous misconceptions about what hospice is and isn't. First of all, I'll tell you what it's not. It's not a place. It's not a venue where a person receives care as an alternative to a hospital or a nursing home. Hospice in the United States is a program largely funded through Medicare, although also accessible through insurance and Medicaid, through which the primary goal of the treatment rendered is maximizing quality of life and alleviating suffering that's related to a terminal illness. That's often not what people think it is. People often think it's a place where you go when you're about to die. And while part of having a terminal illness is indeed dying at the point Hashem decides from that illness, hospice care is actually a much bigger endeavor than that, and it's really aimed at helping people live as best they can despite the unwanted intrusion in their lives of an illness they would have been quite happy never to have encountered and from which they will eventually succumb. And hospice is primarily in the United States set up to facilitate care outside of an institutional setting. It's set up primarily to provide care in the home and provides an infrastructure, which Rabbi Rudansky will probably discuss as well, to provide the supports that primarily family members provide care in the home setting, wherever that patient's home is. Now, if that patient, as hospice has expanded to include patients who have a broad range of illnesses, if that patient happens to reside in room 322 at the nursing home, then that patient can get hospice care in a facility setting. But that's not the primary setup for which hospice care in this country was developed and has been a relatively recent change. And hospice care is set up really to help patients and families figure out what still matters to them in the remaining time as they face a serious illness. Because while we have all had the same fourth grade education, that every moment of life is precious, part of that education as well is the modeling that we have from the Avot about preparing for death, recognizing the importance of realizing that Hashem made us mortals and that we have an obligation to prepare to give over important information to our children about what's important and what we'd like for them to carry on. And in the setting of good hospice care, we see things like patients who have excellent pain and symptom control so that they can go to another simcha and they feel up to it and are able to go and enjoy. Rabbi Rudansky and I shared the care of a patient whose primary goal was to attend the bar mitzvah of his oldest grandson. It was a Sephardi man, and his oldest grandson was his namesake. And as he faced his illness, what was key in his mind was making sure he was there for the bar mitzvah. He came home from the hospital on a Friday afternoon, 2 hours before Erev Yom Kippur, and the bar mitzvah was Sunday morning. And the pictures of this man dancing with his grandson in his wheelchair would take your breath away. And that picture was, without a doubt, the nechama of the entire family 6 weeks later when they were sitting Shiva. So those are the kinds of things that hospice can provide and make it about living rather than dying from a serious illness. And I'm sure there will be more questions. I just want to cover a couple other issues that came up related to the comments that were made before. One is the issue that we have a different calculus about how quality of life is determined and how disability, especially in some of the progressive neurological conditions and Alzheimer's in particular, plays into decisions about continuing therapy. And I think that's something that's very difficult sometimes for our colleagues in the setting of a secular hospital setting to understand. And the more we're able to help articulate that to the caregivers, whether they're nurses or physicians involved in the care of our loved ones, the more successful we can be at making sure we can tailor the care that's appropriate for them, given how they've lived their lives and what their values are, without as many conflicts in the hospital setting. The other thing I want to reiterate is a notion about decision making that Rabbi Dr. Reifman alluded to and how these things have been changing. Issues about disclosure and decision making have changed a great deal under the law in New York State, and I realize not some people may be here from not New York State, but may get healthcare in New York State, and it's important to recognize that there are several important changes in the law with regard to the rights of families to make decisions for patients if those patients lack capacity to make decisions themselves and have not already appointed a healthcare agent to make decisions on their behalf. And it has, the way the law has changed, and I'm not a lawyer, but because of dealing with these things over and over again in the hospital setting, I will tell you that the way this plays out at the bedside has only increased the importance of people who are still able to do so of completing a healthcare proxy document. The major cases in the law that have shaped American public policy about these issues were all young, healthy people who didn't have any specific diagnosis and lost their ability to make decisions. Terry Schiavo, the case that was referred to, Karen Ann Quinlan, which was the first major case in this country, which took place in New Jersey, and also Nancy Cruzan, the famous Supreme Court case in that came out of Missouri. So it's in increased importance in the firm community to complete those documents while one is healthy and able to, and not to wait till there's a diagnosis that compels one to do so. And the final thing I want to do is addresses the last question, or one of the last questions that Rabbi Dr. Reichman brought up, which was this issue about pain medicine or sedation in a patient who's very critically ill and how we adjust and utilize those medicines. One of the things that's very problematic is that it's often portrayed as if these medicines have one and only one effect, and it's negative. And what we sometimes fail to realize, and it's a failure often of how the physicians and nurses present the information to the families or to the RUV, if they are doing what they should do and following the model that was described of having the RUV very actively involved with direct communication with the medical care providers, is to fail to recognize what's the effect of the lack of treatment. If we leave the patient with more pain rather than more pain medicine, how is that going to impact what's going on? I had a question come up recently where a RUV called me and said they want to increase the sedation, but they're afraid it's going to lower the blood pressure. Well, why do they want to increase the sedation? Because the patient is not tolerating the activity of the ventilator and is fighting against the ventilator. Well, in that case, sometimes the sedation and having the patient not fight against the ventilator may actually improve the situation. And yes, there is a risk that the blood pressure will get worse, but there's also a possibility, a significant possibility of a benefit. So it's very important to make sure that we understand not just the cons and the negatives, but also the potential benefits, because all of these questions have two sides, at least, if not three or four or five. And it can be very difficult to synthesize that all that information. And that adds all the more reason why it's so important to have direct communication. And we've seen an enormous difference in Maimonides, where we have a tremendous number of from patients, as you can imagine, being based in Borough Park, that having increased efforts to have direct communication with the patient's POSEC, whoever that is, has made a huge difference in making sure that we get clear and appropriate answers, whatever the answer is, to the complicated questions that go on, because exhausted family members who are dealing with these complicated issues, particularly through long hospital stays, it's very unrealistic to expect they can tell over all of the nuances that are coming to them from often 4 and 5 and 7 doctors, all of whom have somewhat different perspectives on the issues, synthesize all that, tell it over to the RUV, and then get back a PSOC that can be implementable by those people on the medical care team. And having more direct conversation with the POSEC has made an enormous difference. And it's also decreased the tension that arises from this, the conflicts in terms of the general milieu in the hospital often being one of a tendency not to treat and to be less aggressive. There's much less pushback and resistance from the members of the treatment team, whether it's doctors or nurses or social workers, who have that perspective when they can see that there's been a very valid, strong process that's led to a decision, even if it's not a decision they would want to make for their family member, because they're part of a different value system. They're able to implement that decision in a way that's much more positive and can really facilitate good care for the patient and their family. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure now to call upon my Charles Rudansky, who really has had experience on the ground dealing with these issues from a very practical perspective.
I certainly don't really belong here with these distinguished rabbanim and doctors. But that's all right, because many times I feel in an uncomfortable position, not belonging, dealing with a young person that's dying or at a funeral. I always wonder, you know, what am I doing here? I really should not be here. We should be at a different place. And so I want to push the envelope for a moment, and even though a rabbi or a chaplain is supposed to create comfort, I want to create a little discomfort for a few moments, talking about our own deaths. And as Rosh Yeshivas know very well, very willing, to prepare a good shiur, or to understand a shiur, one has to have hachana. One has to prepare. And on some level, we need to prepare ourselves for the inevitable. That we're all mortal. Susan Sontag wrote a beautiful statement. Illness is the night side of life, a more erroneous citizenship. Some of us have dual citizenships, here in America and Eretz Israel, or Europe. But everyone who is born holds dual citizenship. Everyone. Each one of us. In the kingdom of the well, and in the kingdom of the sick. I'd like just to share for a few moments a article that was written by a hospice wife who is on our program. She is writing about her 55-year-old husband who was a physician. Leaning against the cold metal rails of his hospital bed, and each word that she writes has significance, because hospitals are very, very, very important. It brings cure and healing. But there is a time where the hospital is marginalized. And home could be of greater help and significance and support. So here, leaning against the cold metal rails of the hospital bed, I look down at my husband lying flat. That should conjure up a thought. On his back, his dark skin almost as fair as mine under the harsh glare of the fluorescent ceiling lights. The nurse sits next to his bed reading the cardiologist's notes to us from the computer. His diagnosis, significant pulmonary hypertension. And she says that casually, as if she was just reading the weather report. Your numbers are very high. Back and forth, few discussions. At the end of the day, it's time to go home to die. There's nothing more in the hospital that we can do for you. We drove home in silence. And in the weeks that followed our conversation, it took on a different bent. Not about our travels, our next trip, but when I die, he has specific wishes of how to be buried, who to eulogize him. While John took care of the practical matters, getting his affairs in order, business, religious, spiritual, family, I struggled with how to best support him. I knew how to be a wife and a mother, but how does one care for a professional caregiver? How does one care for a man who's built his life caring for others? How can I support the one who always supported me? And it's interesting to note that this physician continued to practice. So it's like Dr. Pop had pointed out, hospice is not about the idea that you're just going to go ahead and end your life in a bed at home. It's an opportunity to recognize the limitations of the body. And he continued to work, and he would come home each day with a new study about his disease that he found online, carefully reviewing the different variables determining his progression each day. Hopes and fears would rise and fall as we compared them with John's case. Hope for the best but prepare for the worst became our daily bread. And also recognizing the risks and the benefits. The wife also wondered that when my husband becomes bedridden, unable to work, what will be? Who will provide for me? When he's no longer able to climb the stairs in the three-story townhouse, how will we be able to maneuver? A few weeks before my husband passed away, he was thinking about an invasive surgery. That might be an option. Pulmonary hypertension was a sudden, unexpected visitor to our lives, and yet we were gradually coming to accept it as a permanent lodger. Unfortunately, illness lurks not too far from all of us at the most unvisited and at the most unprepared times, untimely. What hospice many times offers is an ability for families, for individuals to have the quality and the dignity of leaving this world with a shalom bias in a home setting. I have seen so many times on a Friday afternoon there, the 98-year-old grandmother, Holocaust survivor. Kids come in, the kindler, light the candles, say Kiddush. One's not going to be able to find that in an institutional setting. I think there's a time and place for everything. But to recognize that in the home, one could really provide life-sustaining, emotional, spiritual, and medical support, and also bring the dignity and honor to a person that we want to truly honor, is something to explore. And with the modern health systems that we have, speaking to the right players, discharge planners, physicians, rabbis, thinking in terms of not stopping treatment, but taking that treatment in the home setting, could be very, very life-affirming. This doctor passed away 3 weeks after, well, 3 months after he left the hospital. Surrounded by his son and his wife, in the comfort and the quiet of his own home. So today, we could speak about technology, we could speak about halacha, we could speak about all these important things, but I think we, as human beings, as Jews, need to think in terms, and it's not unprecedented, we do it on Yom Kippur, we think about death. It's not an easy thing to think about. The question that we want to try to convey is, how do I want to die when the time comes? In what setting? Surrounded by whom? These are choices and decisions that we have an opportunity to make when we're alive and healthy. There's a few other comments, but I'm going to pass it on to Rabbi Willig, and we'll have further questions.
Thank you, Rabbi Radansky. It's my zchus to be able to call upon my Rebbe, our Rosh Hashiva, Rabbi Willig Shlita, who as a major posik of our community is frequently presented with some of the shilas that we have been discussing.
Thank you, Rabbi Reese. Thank you, fellow panelists, ladies and gentlemen. It is true that these questions that are posed are among the most difficult, excruciating shalos which have to be analyzed by a rov, attempting to do so in a dispassionate fashion, not only in situations of strangers, but also in very, very close situations where it's even more difficult to make such decisions. I remember once I was at a dinner, it was in Chicago, and I had a cell phone, and it rang, and it was a literally life and death situation. And so I excused myself from this table with all the guests of honor, and all that. I went into the back, and I had to give a difficult response to a very thorny question, and I came back 10 minutes later. I said, you know, this question was so complex that the likes of Rabbi Kiva Eger would probably have to spend hours going through all of Shas in his mind and trying precedent argument and counter argument, Kedarka Shel Torah. And here I am, far away from home, without a sefer anywhere near me. You have to know now, because the doctor said in 10 minutes you have to know what to do or not to do. And this becomes, unfortunately, a recurring theme. I was able to catch the tail end of Rabbi Dr. Reichman's presentation, which I thought was very on target, and was given a little bit of a summary of some of the things which were said earlier by the earlier presenters. And far be it from me to present a view which I view as the only view, when, as you heard earlier this morning, there's such a range of views amongst the recognized Gedolei HaPoskim of our generation and the previous generation. Yes, cognizant of the advances in technology. Sure, there are more every day, but the postum of a generation ago were already aware of these issues with ventilators, and these are not from yesterday, and they each said their piece. And my own position is sort of putting together the guidance of Gedolei HaTorah, to whom, with whom I had a personal connection, or have, and those whose works we read as our Rebbeim. Rebbeim are part of our Mesorah. I have to preface my remarks by saying that my own Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, Zichrono Livracha, did not teach us too much on these particular subjects. There were those who may have had personal questions which they directed towards him, and I'm not aware of their answers directly. But in his shiurim, in public shiurim, of which I attended many, he didn't say too much about these things. However, his relative and individual who's considered the posek in America at that time, Rav Moshe Feinstein, has much to say. I know much of it has been quoted already by the previous speakers. And certainly the Igros Moshe is a mandatory reading for those who have to deal with these questions. Although, as you may have heard before, his positions, while always well thought out, well reasoned, and appeal to our sense of balance, are far from unanimously accepted. As you heard before, there were those in either extreme. One of Rav Moshe's most important comments is that there is a measure of personal autonomy in these decisions. Yes, an irrational decision by a sick person should be ignored, but a rational decision, which could be different for two different individuals facing the exact same illness under the same conditions, we have to take into account the particular decision of that patient. Because, as we know, many treatments involve risks as well as benefits. And while we can decide what we think the halacha would have to say, would recommend in any particular situation, is it worth taking the risk or not worth taking the risk? Rav Moshe taught us there's a measure of personal autonomy. Individual who is well enough, is of sound mind, to say, yes, I know that if I undergo this chemotherapy, there is a chance that my life might be lengthened somewhat. But there's also a much greater chance that the life that I have left to me will be much more fill-in-the-blank, painful, uncomfortable, less dignified, and you can fill in a few other fill-in-the-blank a few other ways. And Rav Moshe tells us that such a patient who makes a decision, please don't give me this chemotherapy, is making a rational decision which should be respected. And no one should give this person a guilt trip that because you're saying a certain thing, you may live shorter than you would otherwise. I believe that you may have seen a citation from the author of the Kilos Yaakov, the Stipler. I'm not sure if it was cited in the oral presentation, but I was told it's in the written handouts. I strongly feel that is a correct position, that is no absolute obligation upon each and every human being to do whatever it takes, no matter what the cost is, to live an extra minute. It's true, notwithstanding that statement, that as a third-party bystander, you may have an obligation to save that life, even in Mechalel Shabbos, to save that life, in a vacuum. We don't know the precise desires of the individual. Those two statements are not necessarily contradictory. The fact that if you come upon a scene and see someone in a certain state of illness without knowing anything, then you'd be duty-bound to try to help if you're a physician, perhaps drive to the hospital on Shabbos if you're an Hatzalah. That's true. But the same person could tell you the day before, under these circumstances, I do not want to be taken to the hospital. I know the situation. I know the circumstance. I know the chances. I studied the odds, and I spoke to my physician, I spoke to my rabbi, and I've decided I don't want to be tangled to the hospital in such a circumstance. Those two are not contradictory. Some rabbis think they are contradictory. But I'm giving you my view. I think it's based on Rav Moshe. They're not necessarily contradictory. This is a crucial distinction. That's number one. Number two. I'm not sure if this point was made before I arrived. We hear about healthcare proxies. I'm a very major supporter of healthcare proxies, 100%. And as a matter of fact, I am a proxy for a number of people who asked me, you know, it's always good to ask Rabbi in advance. Someone say, no one told me you're the proxy. Oh, yeah, well, you're the proxy. So you're the proxy. You don't want to walk away at that point in time. But it's always polite, at least, to tell the Rabbi, you know, I'm putting it down as the proxy. But there is a directive which, from my experience, must be taken very carefully. DNR, DNI, etc. This is not because a DNR is prohibited in and of itself. In many cases, not only is it not prohibited, it's even in theory appropriate. But I emphasize the word in theory. Because unfortunately in practice, and I've seen this time and time again, notwithstanding guarantees of well-meaning doctors, the DNR sometimes is translated by the people on site in the hospital as, if I use an expression, DNT, do not treat. It's probably illegal. And it's certainly not the intention of the person who signed a limited directive, DM, do not resuscitate or do not intubate. Very limited directive. But the sad reality in certain instances is, it's taken as a license, this person has sort of given up on life, he is next of kin. And even if there's something very far from a resuscitation or an intubation, he's treated as a second-class citizen. It's sad for me to say so. There may be doctors in the room who will disagree with me, and I hope you can prove me wrong. But I have too much evidence of what I've seen myself to be easily dissuaded from this empirical observation. Nonetheless, there can be cases in which a DNR should be signed. I'll give two contrasting personal stories. The first was the conversation I heard walking at the shul one day between two individuals who are now both in the world of truth, two Holocaust survivors who would talk to each other in Yiddish. And they sat in the back row of the shul. And one says to the other, Avrum, ich hab gechasmet a DNR. His name was Shloime Gut. Those in my shul know who I'm talking about. Sat in the back of the shul, wonderful Jews. But I knew that these people were completely unsophisticated in these matters. Some doctor had told this person just signed a DNR, and he signed it. There was no illness at the time. Having had to do with Hatzalah from years before, and knowing stories of DNR signed by 30-year-olds, and then when they were caught in an automobile accident, the Hatzalah has to go fight to save his life. They want to give up on him because he signed a DNR, which he wasn't anticipating an automobile accident. So I learned from that story and from others that it's potentially threatening to your own life when your life could be extended for an indefinite number of years. So I spoke that Shabbos in the pulpit in a loud voice, they should hear me in the back, and I said, this is something which is inappropriate. I didn't say, talk only to them, I mean, I had overheard them. And I, almost like a politician, which is not my style of drushes, shul, I said, if you sign such a piece of paper, rip it up! Rip it up! Rip it up! The even more personal circumstance relates to my own family. My mother, Aleha Shalom, had a terminal cancer, and the particular manifestation had spread to the liver, and as a result of that, the lungs were filling up with water. And I remember we had a very wonderful, firm oncologist who was It was Motsoi Shavuos, and how late Shavuos ends. And this man has spent his yontif in the Catskill somewhere, the Poconos. And he came late at night to the hospital to see my mother. It must have been probably close to midnight. And he says to my father and to myself, this is a matter of day two. The lungs are filling up. There's nothing. We pull out all the medical. We tried everything. I think it's time to sign the DNR. Told my father, Abba, you have to sign the DNR. Because otherwise, Chalila, when the breathing gives out, they can be mandated by law in certain places to start pumping the chest with absolute futility and indignity, which would be a disaster. It was a Monday night, close to midnight, after Shavuos. It was a three-day yontif. Like this coming year, 3 day yontif. Shavuos was Sunday. Tuesday night, this is 24 hours later, my mother was, life was ebbing away. I was in the room, and after 2 in the morning or so, the nurse kept coming in every 15 minutes, and I couldn't tell. I saw the breathing getting weaker and weaker and weaker, and just sort of, she said, it stopped. Thankfully, because of that DNR, there was dignity. She died in peace. I don't know what would have happened. I don't even know the hospital protocol. What would have happened otherwise? I shudder to think they'd come to and start pumping the chest with absolute futility and indignity. So yes, there are times when the DNR must be signed. A third possibility, which I'm told works in certain circumstances, and I'm not a physician, is yes, a DNR should be signed, but it shouldn't be given immediately at that point in time to the physician to put on the quote on the charts, because once it's on the charts, all the caregivers around and around know that it's there, and it could lead to the disasters I spoke about, of not caring when there's some totally external problem, which the person could live for a long time. But if it is a serious illness and you want that DNR around in case there is an emergency which would otherwise lead to an inappropriate intubation or resuscitation, in certain circumstances, I'm told, DNR could be signed, and the family that's in control of the situation doesn't give it to the doctors to put it on the charts, puts it in the drawer, so you don't have to go run, find it from 10 miles away in an emergency. But any family member who's there is told, now this is the point. It'll be pulled out of the drawer and then presented to the medical caregivers at that moment in time. Again, I'm sure it's not true in every single situation or every single facility, but that is somewhat of a compromised view with respect to this thorny issue of DNR and DNI. It's widely accepted, and Rav Moshe has this and seems to have this in one of his shuvos, that there are certain minimalist interventions which must be done under all circumstances, particularly hydration, nutrition, and ventilation, and the person should be able to breathe. I'm not sure where this comes from, frankly. I haven't seen any cogent proofs. I did see that Dr. Steinberg, who has a very wonderful encyclopedia on medical and halachic matters, tries to marshal a number of proofs that even in a sense, situation of terminal illness, you are required to give basic support. Rav Moshe has it with respect to food, because it's natural, and Rav Shlomo Zalman has it with respect to air, which is natural. Haven't seen a real proof for it. I'm not sure it's really true according to other authorities. And I would say, and this is going to be an introduction to the rest of my presentation, which will be brief. I heard it from Dr. Reichen before. Case by case basis. To make generalities is very, very dangerous over here. Case by case basis. But at least in some cases, it seems to me, I'm not convinced that that nutrition, hydration, or ventilation, by putting on a ventilator, that's appropriate. Maybe not. Certainly, when an individual is not eating normally, and you're required to put in we call a feeding tube. This in and of itself has risks by definition. Anytime you put in a feeding tube, it has risks. And sometimes the person, I'm not required to undertake such a risk. Whether it be appropriate according to the halacha or not, in my view, usually it is worthwhile taking a risk of putting in a feeding tube. But a person can say, I disagree. In this difficult calculus, as I once mentioned before, Rabbi Bleich Shlita has a very, very wonderful analysis. He weighs risks versus benefits. Doesn't go with the automatic 12-month cutoff, which is called Chaye Shah versus Chaye Olam, as other poskim have gone, but he has a more calibrated approach, which I think makes a lot of sense, although again, there are those who dispute it on either side. But having said this, I don't think it's a requirement, if there is a risk, which there always is, in every situation, to insert in the feeding tube. An individual who doesn't want it should say so in a healthcare proxy, explicitly. I don't want a feeding tube. Now, it could be an unusual case, the person's very young, it's just a temporary emergency, in which case the proxy has the right to override that statement, especially if it's given over to a rabbinical proxy, or the healthcare proxy is told to ask a rabbi. If the rabbi would be myself, I would certainly take what the patient said into account very, very heavily in the typical case that he was probably anticipating. Nebuch, metastasis, or a complete failure of cardiac function, things which can be anticipated. And he meant in those kinds of cases, as the good old Europeans would say, don't mooch me. Hard word to translate. But we understand it, and we appreciate it as a legitimate request made by someone in good health, having experienced around him, whether a parent or a sibling or a relative, it's painful, it's not dignified, they don't want to go through that. And I believe that their request, as I said at the beginning, should be taken into account very, very seriously. It was mentioned before by Rabbi Dr. Reichman, the idea of, yes, if someone's on a ventilator, it doesn't automatically mean that they have to be on the ventilator on the maximum capacity. The maximum capacity gives you more than you would breathe as a healthy person that you and I breathe. If I understand correctly, we are breathing air, which I believe is, 21% oxygen. And we breathe, 6 to 10 times per minute. And the doctors here can correct me from a little more. Okay, it depends who you are. But I understand that the ventilators that are on the maximum put you on 100% oxygen, 20 breaths per minute or more. So they're giving you more than you would. That's not a substitute for normal breathing. That's over and above. So if, again, the person we're going to try to bring back to life and to save him from a crisis, etc., etc., I understand that. What if someone is brain dead? And you assume that brain dead, the person is alive. Are you required to give the person the 100% 20 times a minute? He can stay in this state for a longer period of time? Is it an inevitable death coming down the road? Just a matter of how long it takes. Is there a mitzvah to keep that person alive for a longer period of time? Yes, the stipple, the answer is absolutely not. It probably would be prohibited to keep him alive for a longer period of time in a completely futile situation. Now I know that there are those who quote a Bir Halacha in Siman Shin Chav Tes, who says a case of Nisrotzeitz Mochel, yes, something happened, his head injury, that we have Mechal Shabbos to keep the individual alive. There were those who claim, I believe Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg is one of them, that the fact that he sustained a serious head injury does not mean that he cannot do something in the remaining moments of his life. He writes as a halachist, he can issue a get to his wife. Now, that sounds very unromantic. But if you know that it could have ramifications for, we're learning Yivamis this year in the yeshiva, it could be a very, very important thing to do. Or he can say vidui. Or if it's Shabbos, he can say Kiddush. Whatever he can do in those few extra minutes, even with a serious head injury. But if it's completely non-functioning, Rav Zalman Nechemya is willing to accept the concept, which he articulates in a famous piece which he wrote a long time ago, over 30 years ago, of Tov Moso Mechayov, in which case, in his view, there's no chiyuv of Hatzala. We try to save people whose life has meaning. I know this is a bit of a slippery slope, but sometimes if the person is in a completely comatose state, brain dead state, which means he's never going to have any awareness, and there are those who might even extend it to a severely demented state, Rahman al-Islam, so then withdrawing is problematic, although its precise definitions are also tricky. There was Amnon Chemin suggests that maybe pulling out some of these ventilators might not even be considered killing someone. He's getting air and you're just stopping new air from coming in. That's a matter of great dispute among the various Rabbanim, as well as the ethicists, as we heard already. There's also a distinction whether the person's going to die immediately or not. It's also relevant in this calculation as he makes in that same Ma'ar written over 30 years ago. But it seems to me, and that's how I handled it, that there's no need, a very tragic brain-dead situation. It was someone attempted to take a life and was just about successful. And the poor parents are sitting there with this child. The child is healthy, young. Could have gone on for who knows how long. I think weeks or months. And I said, lower it to 21% and whatever, it's 8 times a minute, whatever the case may be. So what happened? They did it. And the alarms started going. This is the hospital on Main Street. It used to be old Booth. Now it's in New York. And they come in, it's Gewalt. So the relative who happened to be in a physician said, no, leave it this way. So we can't leave it this way because we have to, the alarm is going off because certain enzymes were... So they said, this person is already brain dead. So they said, okay, so pull the plug. In other words, they didn't get it. Either pull the plug or put it back to 100% 20 times a minute. And the crazy rabbi, it was me, said, no, neither extreme. You can follow a middle course. And they did that at the end of the day, and the person's neshama was taken away in a much shorter order, sparing the ordeal of which could have been in almost indefinite for these parents. That's what I felt. I must tell you that I told this over to Rav Shech the Shalita. He wasn't so happy with my psak, and I was really, I felt it was a very thin ice because I just saw this on my own. Later, I found it printed by Rabbi Dr. Steinberg in his encyclopedia in the name of, I quote from two people, one you can still check with, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman, Zichrono Levracha, and Lehavdil ben Chaim, Lechaim Rav Vosner from Bnei Brak, who apparently said the exact same thing that Baruch Shekivanti, can I call these according to this report? So you see, I'm just giving a few examples, and if we can spend hours about case after case after case, of the complexity of these issues. They're so complicated and so difficult. And yes, let's not be afraid to say it, so controversial. So controversial. If I'm not mistaken, I spoke in Brooklyn with the same two distinguished panelists who are sitting next to me, and it emerged that the Rabbanim, who took the most, quote, liberal position, quote, liberal position, and not necessarily fighting for each and every breath and where it's going to cause extra pain or indignity, as the case may be, were, of all people, the Hasidic poskim, were usually known for being, very, very strict and what they call today fundamentalist and other whatever names they want to give to them. But apparently they were the ones who were the most understanding of this kind of a moderate approach, which I espouse, which of course is not in any way, shape, or form giving up on life just because of age. I got the person is X years old. I rather say irrelevant. Irrelevant. It doesn't matter. Chas v'shalom. Who cares how old the person is? The question: how long can they live? Is there a terminal disease, or they're just old? They're old. We want to get older, right? Everyone wants to get older. We say, maybe no one ever came to you. The person's 120 something. I've been over 100. I've gotten a case over 100, but never. I've never gotten the case. Have any doctors here gotten a case over 120? So what do we? Every time you write a letter, I may have asked from Shana. So what do you mean? You're old. There's no such thing as old. ill? Is it terminal illness? Is it not? There's so many different significant factors. So in some ways I found out a sort of a Hasidish person. I do have a lot of Hasidish blood. Now that is true. Although my training is more in the, I guess you might call it the Lithuanian school, where according to these, my Brooklyn panelists or others who are there in attendance, there's a bit more of a view that you have to fight for every breath. And that's also the opinion, by the way, of Chabad, because that was the opinion of the Rebbe. And there these people just don't ever try to reason with individuals like that, because they have their hard and fast position to which they're entitled to, according to Halacha, and just have to let it be. And I'll conclude with this. You know, it says in the Gemara that when someone passes away, you say, Lech b'sholom, go in peace. To me, it's one of the most critical elements of these situations. And you'll say, that what right do we have to discuss peace when talking about Pikuach Nefesh? The answer is no, we do have, especially when things are controversial. I've often been called in by families where there's a dispute, either on the basis of the siblings themselves arguing about what to do with the parent, or equally often, each had different rabbis. One rabbi said this, one rabbi said this. I'm also called in as a Kosev HaShlishi. And in these kinds of circumstances, one of my major goals is to achieve the Lech B'Sholom, that the family should be at peace with whatever decision they make. And sometimes this may lead to a recommendation that a person should be kept alive in a circumstance with left to my own devices. I might say perhaps not. But I don't want anyone to say, you know, we could have kept them alive and you should have kept them alive and you're a murderer, one sibling saying to another. That would be the absolute worst thing that could ever happen in a family. You know, I wrote a mimer just recently in a completely different context, discussing a different kind of a will, not a healthcare proxy kind of will, but a financial will, where I wrote at the beginning, at the end of the article, that the most important thing that a person who has been blessed with money is to make sure that when he passes away, there shouldn't be a fight in the family about that. Well, certainly in our case, there shouldn't be a fight in the family about these things. And they have to take that into account. And you know what? It seems to me that's perfectly legitimate even within the strict contours of halacha. Because when you take into account the desire of the patient who was not given specific instructions, I take it the liberty to say the desire of any straight-thinking patient is that his children should live in peace. So that's integrated as part of the absolute medical decision. What does the patient want? Now, the patient couldn't foresee when he filled out a proxy, or he didn't fill out a proxy, what's going to happen down the road when his son and his daughter are having this bitter feud they both want for the well-being of the father or mother. So it comes to a Rav, if I'm the Rav who's on site, who does take that into account, among other considerations, in these circumstances. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Willis. We have just a few minutes left for some questions from the audience. We also have some questions that have been submitted to us. I'll just start with one in front of me, which is perhaps the major unstated question that underlies much of the discussion that we've had today. Just to put it out there, recognizing that it's difficult to ask any questions that lend themselves to an easy yes or no answer, Rabbi Willing, is the institution of hospice in fact compatible with halal?
Yes.
Okay, from the audience. Yes, Rabbi Willing.
Okay, I'd like to ask Rabbi Willing if he has any guidance. Today, one gets questions about Alzheimer's patients. And the question is, a person who is withdrawn does not speak, does not communicate, comes out with pneumonia. Is one permitted to say, let's not treat him?
I'll repeat the question. A person has, I'll just rephrase it, has severe dementia from Alzheimer's. I'm not sure if that's what you had in mind. And unfortunately, the life is a life of indignity, a lack of meaningful awareness. Then he comes down with a totally different disease, pneumonia. The only way to keep him alive is to have what I'll consider to be heroic intervention. Maybe you have to give him face strong antibiotics and maybe even put him on a respirator, etc., etc. Is it permitted not to treat such a patient? That's the question. It seems to me that's a much more difficult question than Rabbi Reese's question. This is it. And also a very on-point question. And here's where I am, what I consider myself a moderate. In my opinion, in some situations, again, case by case, the answer to that question may be yes, that it may be permissible not to treat an external condition known as pneumonia if by treating it you're going to bring it back to a life which is not with any meaningful awareness and only has dementia and indignity. I believe in certain conditions the answer to that question is yes, and I know that there are those who don't agree with me. And someone who doesn't agree with me has my blessing. I'm not saying kabbalu daiti, but I'm going out on a limb and saying that in my view, in certain cases, I don't want to be generalized in any which way, the answer to your question may be yes.
Okay. We have time for one or two more questions. Yes.
Certainly there's a fair amount of research that good quality palliative care, whether it's rendered through a hospice program or through a palliative care program that isn't constrained by all of the Medicare regulations, has been shown to be of benefit to many subpopulations of patients. It's, you know, there's research in the New England Journal and very high quality medical journals showing that it can be of benefit not only in terms of quality of life, but also in terms of extension of life and duration of survival. And most good quality hospices, not only in the New York area, but outside of New York City, will, with proper guidance, be able to provide care that will be consistent with halacha. The hospices in the New York City area often have a fair amount of experience with doing this and may have it very well integrated into their operations. Hospices in other places, I'm originally from the Midwest, but I've had opportunities to give advice to people throughout the country, can, with guidance, do this. They may just need to be brought up to speed and be given instruction about what that means to provide care in a hospice program that's consistent with halacha and how to bring the patient's posek into the treatment team. But it absolutely can be done.
I'll just interject that in a shul setting, you have to have this happen at least once. One of the fine women from our shul who had a very difficult cancer, and there was nothing they could do, she was transferred to the hospice facility, which is right across the street from Einstein. I think it's called Calvary. And I went to visit her there. I must say I was extraordinarily impressed. From what I could see, that is extraordinarily superior care. Yes, the caregivers are from a different faith, but watching the way they do things, I was very, very impressed. And I was the rabbi. They knew I was a rabbi. I wasn't from their faith. They treated me with utmost respect, and whatever I said, they tried to implement. And, we in our world, in our Jewish world, are attempting to reach that kind of level of care. Certainly it's a goal which is important, and I support it wholeheartedly.
One last question, Rabbi Zohar.
Just as a follow-up, Dr. Pop, I think in your answer to this question, you intimated that there are certain questions that may arise in choosing a hospice. Could you just focus, or could Rabbi Willen focus, on what those questions might be? Because I think that the general population does not necessarily understand what the issues are from going into a hospice that you need to make sure that they are willing to work with.
I would usually ask three or four questions. One is, are they prepared to let the patient's posek be a formal part of the hospice care team, interdisciplinary team? That's number one. Number two, I would ask how they would deal with certain complications that are likely to come up, and what those complications are really depends on what the specific illness is. There are, you know, things that are more likely to come up if we're dealing with a cancer illness, and which particular kind of cancer, than with Alzheimer's, than with ALS, than with Parkinson's, than with kidney failure when someone's not going to go on dialysis. So the specific likely situations vary, but there are usually three or four sort of highly likely situations to come up, depending on what the illness are, and I would ask how those will be addressed, and are they prepared to be flexible and address them in accordance with the Piskei Halacha that the patient's posek gives. Artificial nutrition and hydration is frequently an issue, irrespective of the underlying disease, and also whether or not a DNR needs to be in place or for the patient to be in hospice, because there are, you know, we certainly see a wide variety of opinions and Piskei Halacha given to patients and their families, which may impact their accessing hospice care or how that hospice care will be provided and what constraints that the program is prepared to take. So that's in a nutshell.
I just want to add one thing. I had a recent case, another sad case of a terminal cancer, and I recommended the same hospice, and the other rabbis were very strongly opposed to that recommendation. Be aware of that. It's important to be aware of that. And it got a little bit testy. The person passed away the next day, so it became moot. But the other rabbi, who was clearly was not comfortable with what I had said, expressed his view to somebody, and it's important to know that too. That you know, they came to me. I was involved in the questions from the beginning, and so we just reached that point. And the husband was a friend of mine for over 40 years, so he came to me. But the rabbi in the particular community was not necessarily in favor of what I had said. And that could be something which you have to try to anticipate, as I said before, in trying to achieve the Leich B'Shalom that we spoke about earlier. I just want to say that a lot of people had their hands up before. I know Rabbi Reese is going to end the formal session now, but if you have any questions you want to ask privately, I will stay here until you ask those questions. Thank you very much.